Welcome to Tiny House Tales, a podcast about the experiences of people who have joined the tiny house movement. I'm John Weisbarth.
And I'm Zach Giffen. Enjoy as we give listeners a behind-the-scenes glimpse into the absolute joys and inherent challenges of living tiny.
Together, we'll seek to unlock the successful strategies for minimalist living and learn more about how tiny living has made a big impact on people's lives.
Entertaining and informative, Tiny House Tales is mandatory listening for anyone who has ever dreamed of downsizing or has simply craved a more simple lifestyle.
Welcome to Tiny House Tales. Nailed it.
But do we need a drum roll? Should we start with a drum roll, or how do we do this?
I think we just start because you've got that big old smile on your face because I've had technical issues. It makes you so happy, doesn't it?
Oh, John. Well, as you know, I'm more of a woodcutter than a computer guy, and so I am super accustomed to being the one that holds up the program because I haven't gotten my crap together.
Yeah.
And I'm just so happy that it wasn't me this time.
I know. I just feel like the world is upside down right now. I don't know what's going on. Like, you're great with the computer. Mine's all screwed up. I'm all flustered.
Oh. Is that sawdust on your hat?
Yeah, what is going on?
Are we switching roles?
Oh, man, we might be. I do think I look a little bit more handsome. So, yeah, we might be officially switching roles.
No, I can tell you it's actually you're the same.
Oh, but for good, right? And by the way, speaking of the same, we haven't seen each other for a little bit. We had a little bit of break. Beard is still going strong, pal. You are,
thank you.
Grizzly.
Well, you know, in some parts of the country, it might be springtime, but here it is still in the throes of winter in a heavy-duty way, so I'm still cultivating my warmth.
Dude, we're not even down here in Southern California. They just said, like, Big Bear's going to be skiing until July. I mean, it's crazy the weather we've been having.
Yeah, congratulations. I'm glad you finally have a winner down there. I think that the whole world can kind of celebrate considering that, you know, so much of the world's food source comes from the Central Valley and, you know, the aquifers are getting drained. And now here we have a chance to actually get it a little bit back to normal. But, you know,
I love that our podcast has turned into an agricultural podcast and a weather podcast.
But it's not. It's just the current events and, you know, how things relate to tiny houses. And as you know me, I think that tiny homes relate to everything.
Oh, I know. I know. I remember when you told me that you thought tiny houses could save the world. I was like, that's hilarious. You're like, I'm serious. I was like, oh. And now I've come to learn just how serious you are about that. And speaking of serious, how seriously excited are you about today's show? Because this is one that I feel like you've been wanting this one before we even had a podcast, I feel like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's not all that many people out there in the tiny home world where I kind of feel like I'm in the position of being a fanboy. And this is kind of the top of the list there because, okay, if you were to describe our guest on the show today, or you were to ask me to describe it, what I would say is that ask your very favorite tiny home builder who their favorite tiny home builder is, and that's Abel
Zill, who has Zill Vardos, who is our guest. And Abel, we'll just bring you in, buddy. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. Thank you for having me. Hello. Hi.
Yeah, of course. So this is true that, like, I've worked a lot with Zach over the years. And let me tell you, when we go places together, if anyone calls out my name, it's because they're like, John, move over. We can't see Zach. I mean, like, people love Zach. And for Zach to be the biggest fanboy of you should tell our listeners something about what you do, how you do it, and kind of the quality of what you do as a builder. We're going to get into all of that. I know Zach has so many questions for you. I kind of want to start with you, Abel, from the very beginning, because, you know, I know why Zach got into woodworking. I understand that path. And I know that you had a father also that was handy, that had tools, that sort of passed that down to you. I guess that's my question. Where did that love of woodworking come from? Was it your dad?
Yeah, he definitely got me going in that direction, mainly because he always gave me the tools and the materials. And he was always building something. He, you know, my parents were kind of came from the hippie methodology, and they attempted to do a lot of things themselves when they were younger. And when they first had us kids, yeah, there was always something going on, like some funky ass woodshed made of free chunks of wood that were cut off the sides of logs and, you know, with bugs in them. And yeah, I have to credit my dad for getting me started and basically just allowing me to do what I wanted and make the mistakes I wanted.
So I got a question then. Does he still try to coach you on how to be safe on a table saw? Because my dad does.
You know, my dad, he is a safety monitoring kind of person. Not to a fault. He's also really laid back. Like I said, he came from the hippie way of being and like, he doesn't get too stressed out. I feel like I'm the one that's the table saw safety monster now, you know, like, hey, make sure you don't put the push stick in that way, or like crank down the blade a little bit. Or
Abel, I would love to see your dad and Zach's dad have a hippie off, because I mean, Zach's dad was a pretty big hippie back in the day too.
Yeah, but then he kind of turned into a machinist, and then he kind of like it's when you start working kind of with unnatural materials, I think it just naturally kind of pulls you into kind of a little bit of a different mentality. Mm. You know, he started out as a potter, and he was kind of like a do-it-all kind of person. And he definitely knew his way around a table saw, right? But there was a point in my life when it kind of dawned on me in that, like, he was still trying to tell me how to be safe on a table saw. And then I'm thinking, wow, actually, I think that my, like, sheer hours on a table saw probably outnumber his, probably 30 to 1 at least. And so that kind of was a moment where I had to give myself permission to say, okay, actually, yeah, your dad has got a lot of experience, but you can't discount your own experience in this world because you're not a child anymore.
Right, right.
Anyways, this is not an interview about me and my dad. I want to know, where'd it go? Like, how did you first get into being professional in construction?
Well, it kind of came in bits and pieces as I moved out of the home and started being a, you know, laboring individual, grown up, so to speak. My first few jobs were dorky. You know, they were like, well, Jack in the Box. And like, I worked in this alarm monitoring center, which was like soul sucking, you know, cave sort of thing with telephones and computers. And then I got on with the state of Washington. So I was like a public servant for a little while doing clerical work at a desk, which drove me nuts. So I would take side jobs for friends and, you know, I build them shelves, or I always was getting my hands into electrical work. That's like a little thread that has carried on through my life. Still do electrical work here and there. Eventually, as the years went by, I quit working for the state and I kind of punkified a little bit, and I was living downtown and doing odd jobs and handiwork for people. And I decided to build myself a tiny house, and that kind of started the tiny house and its attached carpentry journey. Dee Williams was the one that egged me on, because I would walk past hers going to the little co-op that was down the street from me. You know, one day I think I approached her and I was like, hey, really, your tiny house is really cool. I've been thinking of doing one myself, but, you know, I don't know where to build. And she's like, do it. And I'm like, well, all I have is this alley behind. And she's like, yeah, just do it. And I was like, okay. So I took her little push and built my first. And then the rest is kind of history.
I love hearing that, because I feel like we as a community or as a movement, we owe Dee quite a lot. And then now what you're telling me is that everybody that appreciates the homes that you build, we can really thank Dee for that. She gets the credit?
Yeah, for starting me in that path. Like, I was thinking about doing like marine carpentry and stuff like that, but that's kind of in Olympia, that's kind of a torturous, seasonal, hard to make money. I just had a kid. So like, I really quickly realized I cannot support my kid being like some grungy punk boat worker who doesn't get work all winter. so carpentry it was.
You know, Abel, you mentioned the marine building. Yeah. And it seems very obvious that some of that may like plays over into your designs. I mean, there's something to me, I guess it's the curbs and stuff. And it may not be specifically, you know, based on a boat, because a lot of the things you do are very whimsical, but there is like this ship building quality to your style of carpentry and architecture and design. Do you see that as well? Do you credit that time, like considering doing some marine building, doing a little bit of it, in sort of influencing what your style is?
Yes, absolutely. There was definitely some overlap at a point. I had studied a little bit about marine, like boat design and boat building. Again, kind of quickly decided that wasn't what I wanted to pursue as like an ongoing career. But I had worked for this hilarious, like one-eyed guy named Patrick at this youth program. It's like a nonprofit youth program called Sound Opportunities. I think it's defunct now. We were working on these old sailboats, and sometimes I realized that Patrick didn't even intend to finish the projects. It was just to get these kids and these teenagers who were kind of wayward and needed this something to focus on, to focus on something for a little bit. So that's what a lot of the projects kind of orbited around, was like getting some projects enough that the kids can like strip some paint and like caulk some seams and do the old boat building stuff. And then they would go on like this rowing trip every summer. Anyway, so yeah, that it integrated with my early design. Well, it still does, but I feel like I've kind of evolved beyond what came directly from the marine methodology of design and such.
Yeah, I think that it probably is worth mentioning to anyone who's listening that isn't really familiar with what Able does, the homes. Just go search for Zilvardo's Tiny Homes, scroll through some photos, and you'll see exactly instantly what we're talking about. I mean, your homes there are some straight edges, right?
Yeah, a few.
But
at least
the common denominator, I think, with all of Able's homes is, yeah, it is very dramatic shapes. There's dramatic rounds. And, you know, as a carpenter, anytime you see something that isn't kind of square corners, what it does is it screams to you, oh my God, that's really difficult to achieve. And so people try to avoid it. And I think what distinguishes all of the homes that you do is that instead of kind of trying to avoid it, you're leaning into that. And I know that you've influenced a lot of other tiny home builders to try to kind of up their game. And maybe that seems kind of like imitation, but I almost feel like it's got to feel flattering a little bit because nobody else is doing it that level. How do you feel about that?
I guess it does sometimes feel a little flattering sometimes somebody will contact me and be like, hey, I'm doing a knockoff of like the fortune cookie design or whatever. That's the name of one of my like round sided tiny houses. But I like that people are kind of taking that and running with it. You know, like it's doing work like this as a dialogue and no two people will do it the same. So it doesn't feel like, you know, like I don't feel like people are ripping me off. I mean, if they were, you know, maybe I'd know it, but that's a different thing. And I don't think that's really happened because my building techniques are fairly complicated and most people don't want to, that's like not something they want to bite off as a business anyway. So yeah, I kind of embrace other folks doing it.
Can I ask you a question? And this is something that Zach and I have talked about, and I know what Zach's answer is, but I'm curious for you, why is it important what the house looks like? I mean, if you're making a tiny house and you have an economy of space, then making a big box, you'll get the most space usage
right,
out of it.
True.
And yet that's not at all what you do. And why is that important, though, to you? Why does it matter?
Well, I guess there's multiple reasons. Functionally, a rounded shape is very strong. And so there is a functional reason. But you can achieve as much strength by reinforcing a box or whatever. But I think aesthetically, a design that flows or like that sits with itself, where things kind of flow into one another, there's something really special about that. And you know, nature shows us that wherever you look, you know, the way that like grass grows or rocks pile up at the bottom of a slope or whatever, it has a flow and it has a sort of a logic to it. You know, it like keys in with like our human feelings and perception on maybe a level that we don't know how to describe always. But I feel like that's why making a kind of a harmonious or flowing design is pleasing to people. And hopefully it's not just me that feels that way. I mean, because people like pay me to build these things. So it isn't just me, but yeah.
Well, one thing that I've said, and I think that this is probably one of my most controversial opinions, is that, you know, before the movement of tiny homes came along, there were other small homes, right? And there were actually other small homes on wheels.
Absolutely.
And when tiny homes, when I was exposed to what was called a tiny home, the definition in my mind, just not from asking anybody, but just from observing what it was, is that it was a tiny, it was a home on wheels that was small, but also was built with kind of the quality expectations or the obvious craftsmanship that you would expect from like a custom home, the type of things that I had been paid, you know, all the way through my 20s to construct.
Right, right.
Whereas other homes that were on wheels were really, the focus was on affordability. And as soon as you start really prioritizing affordability, things, a lot of the things that you do kind of go out the window,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
All of these things that take longer. But to me, the controversial part of my opinion is that, like, as the tiny home movement has kind of matured a little bit and has, you know, as the housing crisis has become more pronounced, that there has been more and more of the industry has been focused on affordability. And so the sacrifice kind of has been some of those aesthetic elements that, in my mind, kind of were the hallmark or the calling card of what made a tiny home a tiny home. And so, you know, to me, when I look at a lot of the homes that are produced now that are really kind of similar shapes to each other, and they kind of end up being more rectangles with a single pitch shed roof, which, as John was saying, that is like going to give you the most amount of interior space and keep you in the restraints of the rules of the road, you know, the size right, restrictions right. of the road. But what I feel is that if that was the home that was getting produced in the very beginning, we would have never had a tiny home movement because it would have never been, it would have never warranted a new name,
yeah.
if that makes sense.
It would have been, just
a different style of a trailer home.
Yeah, totally.
And so the controversial part of my opinion is that I think without that obvious aesthetic difference, I don't think that there would have been a real reason why people would have had to come up with a new kind of terminology right. to describe the
home. Well, in Jay Schaefer's early work of doing these little, like very small houses with little craftsman-esque and like pretty windows, like formed that idea in people's minds early on. But like small structures are nothing new, and people have done creative, weird little cabins and buses and house trucks. Like the tiny house movement isn't itself a new human activity. It just goes together a little differently and is used just a little differently than it was before.
Yeah, actually, that brings up a good point because, you know, the name of your company is Zilvardos.
Mm-hmm.
And a Vardos is a different type of structure than a tiny home.
Yeah, yeah.
Essentially, right? And so what was it that led you to call your company instead of Zil Tiny Home? You
know? Well, by the way, what is a Vardos? I have no idea. You guys, I'm like out of the loop here.
I can explain. A Vardo is the Rom word for, or gypsy word, if you will, for a small, movable living structure, which is usually small enough to be pulled by a horse or two. And the image that people know of those comes from like Northern Europe, but there are a lot of different forms. But the more artistic ones, obviously, are the ones that people think about, these carved wood with paint, bright colored paint. And again, I have to credit Dee with tacking that onto my name. She kind of made that name up for me. And I ran with it at the time because it had a ring to it. However, my company, although that is still one of the names, I added on the name Zil Tiny Homes. And so maybe at the moment, I should say that if somebody was going to search me out, they can find me either way. But the new website should go up shortly, and it'll be Zil Tiny Homes because it's more descriptive of what I actually do. And I'm not trained in that traditional method. So, you know, if somebody who does know what one of those is like, can you build me a Vardo? And I'm like, well, do you mean the Rom thing from Northern Europe? Then no, I haven't been trained that way. I mean, I think you should contact some builders that do that. And does that make sense?
Yeah, but I don't buy it. I think that if they want a Vardo, they should come to you. Because your work, in my mind, is it might not be traditionalist, but is absolutely in the spirit of everything mm-hmm. that anyone could hope for. Mm-hmm. if they were looking for a Bardo.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
Abel, I have a question for you concerning your work.
Yeah.
How do you view your work? Do you view it as performative, artistic? I mean, I think it's probably all of these things. It's also very utilitarian. I mean, you are building a home and putting a roof over someone's house. Hmm. There is a huge artistic quality to it. There is a lot of engineering that goes into it. It seems like it has so many different things. And I know that you're a performer also. Besides that, I just wonder, how do you view your work?
Well, and yeah, you're right. I think I've had kind of the idea that it was somewhat performative early on, maybe when I got or responded more to social media and such. But at the moment, it's really kind of distilled down to its essential dichotomy, isn't quite the right word, but I do approach it from an artistic standpoint. And that requires a really kind of deep and unique focus. And the counterpart to that is the design and engineering and functionality, like not only to make it kind of safe and up to our current standards of a house for fire protection and materials, toxicity and stuff like that, but to make it work for the people that live in it. And all that's kind of concentrated in a tiny house because everything's closer together. So you kind of got to get fit and function right. I mean, you all know that very well because you've done it over and over and more rapidly than I do with your shows and going through these builds in just a number of weeks. If that days seems like, but yeah, it's the art and the design and engineering and function are the two kind of weights on either end of the stick.
I mean, that's a good point. But they're not unrelated. It's almost like there is art in the engineering, you know, in the science of what you're doing, if you want to call it that. I mean, I think it's just, but they do, to balance them out in a way is something that I've always found really interesting. And it's something that I think Zach thinks about all the time as well, especially the part about what you said, Abel, about all these things to consider, but maybe the most important is like what part of the homeowner is in the house. I don't know if that's like, if I'm saying that exactly the right way, but one of the things that Zach would always push, we'd always push, it's like he wanted someone to walk into the house and go like, oh, of course this is Jeff and Stephanie's house. That makes sense. There's something about it, whether it was a, you know, a humidor in the stairs or a drying rack for gear or like a beautiful door that depicted some mountains, you know, that they lived in. Like there was always that thing. And Zach, I know that was a big, important part of every build that we did for you to discover what it was and then to surprise them. And oftentimes off script, sometimes the stuff didn't even get shot. But you still did it because you're like, hey, this is their home.
Yeah, I think in my defense, I think what I was really trying to do was acknowledge that when you're building someone a home, at the very end of the day, the only thing that I really care about is that they are proud of it, right? Is that they love it and they're proud to say, this is my home, you know? And especially when you start building on more of a price point focus, right? Which is important to a lot of people for a lot of reasons, that what I believe is that it doesn't necessarily always take so much to give them that sense of like, yes, this is my house. This is, you know, this is what I love, but, and that sense of pride. And I think with the work that I've done with building tiny homes for homeless veterans, that's another thing that I really try to include in it is that like, hey, if you're just giving someone a roof over their head, that's one thing. But if you can give them a roof over their head that actually feels dignified and like to the point where they are proud to show it off to people, well, then that pride in their space can kind of manifest into self-esteem in all sorts of different ways. And I feel like it's a complete package.
Right, right.
It's a much better gift.
That is true. That's absolutely true. If you just needed something to like keep you warm, you'd put on black woolies in the morning and that would be it. But maybe like, those SpongeBob SquarePants socks that I have are what I need to make it feel like me, you know? And it's like that with the house too. Yeah, yeah, I do have the privilege, I guess, of being able to personally be involved in making the home that I'm building for somebody fit them. And there's always money constraints if somebody's asking for, you know, 13 stained glass windows or something, that costs a lot. But it sometimes the little things that matter.
Well, I think that that actually is a really good way to describe, I think, my take on artistry. And the what I see from your homes is an undeniable artistry in them. I mean, you are a craftsman, but then the home that you produce, it just really feels like it is a work of art. You know, no matter what home it is, there is just, it's art. And to me, I think what that kind of comes down to is that artists, it doesn't, for an artist, to me, it's not just about the final result. It's also about the process and, you know, and retaining your principles in terms of maintaining how that home was constructed. And when I know a little bit about you, and I'd love you to talk about your story on this in terms of, you know, you are such a principled person in terms of not just the final result, but how you're actually constructing it, that to me, and that in pride and the importance, the priority you put on having your own personal involvement in every aspect of the construction, it kind of tips the scales to me to make it such an obvious work of art.
Yeah, it would be really hard to do it if I wasn't fairly involved. Right now, I work with two carpenters and they're great, but they're not too interested in taking, I'm okay with them taking the helm on stuff, but mostly they're like, we like that you do all the like hard work and the talking with the client and the working out the details. And so it's me a lot of the time, but that's how I like it. And I can only do that like one house at a time, basically. I go slowly. I don't try to stack up too many builds or make profiting off repetition a priority.
Well, I mean, I think that's what Zach is talking about too, is also just the fact that like you're, and part of it is necessity, but you're hand building windows and making custom doors and making sure that all the material you're using, you're sourcing that from a place where you know that it's good quality, that, you know, the toxicity, all that stuff. That, those are places where you could take a shortcut and still produce the beautiful homes you're doing, but there would be, I think what Zach's getting at is a little bit of that soul, that moral code that you bring to it would be missing, and it would somehow be less than. And I think, I guess, why is that so important to you?
Wow. I know what you're saying. Like, I feel that. Why it's important to me? I mean, that might hook back into the artistry thing. You know, you kind of hold yourself to some sort of relative, I mean, you have to be easy on yourself at some point or else you'd never get anything done. But you, like, as an artist, because I do other kinds of art, I do music and such, at some point when you're getting a piece together that's a like a creative piece that you've made from scratch, you hold yourself to this extremely high standard. Like, you're trying to hone it and make it better than anybody else has done. And I guess that drives me a little bit, that, you know, kind of artistic, you know, that artistic kind of ever kind of seeking to make it a little better or a little more cohesive or a little more functional. And that informs my, you know, my engineering process. I have this kind of way of writing down after each house, like what worked for the clients and what was difficult in the design process and what my carpenters had a hard time with. And then next time we build something like that, I look at all the notes and reinvent the things that I need to, but not everything. So I'm not reinventing the wheel every time. And in that way, everything kind of gets a little bit better. And that's something that's been very much my focus in the last, like, I want to say like 4 years or so. And that's why I've been a little quiet in like the outer world, as I've been developing the things that I think are working for people that I build for and for me in the process of creating these houses, where a lot of the pieces are made in the shop in a way that they're like made, well, I think like very high quality, but they're not also extremely high priced. It's a little expensive to build this way, but it's not as expensive as if you went to a custom woodworker and asked for the exact same thing. They'd probably charge twice as much, and just because that's what they do for custom requests.
That actually is something that I'm curious about, just hearing you talk, is okay, where, for you personally, where do you draw the line? You know, because you're talking about kind of refining your process and trying to get it so that you can do it a little easier. But at the same time, it's so obvious that you are retaining this quality standard, this hands-on approach, this attention to things being unique and one of a kind. And so like what goes on through your head when you're thinking about, okay, well, maybe I can mass produce this element of the home and then drive down the cost. What are the factors that go into your consideration on whether or not you're willing to do that?
Oh, you mean like draws the line about like how far I take the improvement process of something? Yeah, I can actually put my finger on that, because what draws the line is the budget and what works for my carpenters that I work with. Like, I love these people and, you know, I hope they stay around for a long time. These two have been with me. One of them I built with for years and years and years, and the other has been with me for the last 3.5 so years. So we've all been together for a little bit. And so one is the budget, because there's a cost to time, even though I'd like to think there's not. And I do work on things for very little or no pay sometimes because I want to, and I like it that way. But I also have to pay my bills sometimes, and I can't hand everything back to the client. And sometimes we're like, this is how much we're going to spend for the whole project. And so, yeah, that's one of the balancing acts that you have to do is the budget. The other is, you know, what my carpenters are willing to do and can do and what we can all do together. Like, that's a defining factor. And then the third one is that I have somebody else that wants me to build a house afterwards. So there's this kind of nice motivation. It's a good thing for me to move on from a project, to like do this crazy thing and like get really involved in it, and then be like, okay, this is how we're going to close the box and give it to them and move on to the next project and open a new box.
I can completely relate to that, because one of the things that I thought was such a gift about being not just getting to build tiny homes, but for me personally, getting to build them on the show, was that it wasn't up to me. It was rapid fire, right, whether I liked it or not.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? So I was kind of, as an artist, I think I was pigeonholed into this capacity of just like, I had to come up with something and I had to execute it really fast. And so that's it didn't amazing. Leave any time to kind of second guess myself. Mm-hmm. And that was such a gift, because it allowed you to just practice, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
what I found was even as scary as it is, even though you want to like, okay, let's slow down, make sure that we're doing everything perfect, you end up impressing yourself more than you'd expect when you get pushed into something and you get given a deadline. Yeah. And so I've learned to really appreciate that. It's kind of refreshing hearing that you're having the same thing happen.
Well, Zach, I remember I asked you about that specifically. Like when we were like 30 episodes in, I'm like, geez, man, it doesn't look like we're stopping anytime soon. Like, how do you do all this? And you said something to me that I'm hearing Abel say, and you basically said it, but it was, you said the art is in the limitations. It's like, if I had unlimited resources and unlimited time, it's like, maybe I would never get done. But exactly what you said, you're like, I got to make a decision. I got to go fast. I've got to go. And there was something that I've thought about that in all creative endeavors, you know, and I wonder, you know, Abel, how much your other performative things, your music, I know you did some like trapeze dance work stuff,
the circus
and, you know,
stuff,
as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, yeah, that very much works that way. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know you talked about the idea of the show must go on, and really what that really is just like, is getting a group of people that you trust together and being like, okay, what can we do? We can surprise ourselves, as Zach said. I just think if we're talking about a bigger creative idea, whether it's writing or performing or woodworking or whatever, I think those are some real true lessons. And I think both of you guys, Zach and Abel, have put a lot of thought into the creative endeavor. And I love to just sit and listen and kind of understand and try to glean some of that thought process. That's not really a question, but that's how I feel.
Yeah, nothing drives people to work quickly and a lot by having like 1 week off from first show deadline. I mean, in TV, I'm sure you feel that all the time.
Yeah, well, to me, it was very important that, you know, the projects that I did, I wasn't borrowing them. In quotes.
Right.
Otherwise, I wasn't copying other people's designs. And I, you know, it was almost the kind of thing where it was like, if somebody had a good idea, I would be like, no, do not tell me. Because as soon as you tell me what your idea is, it's guaranteed that I'm not going to do it. Because like, I have a certain amount of principle. And one of those principles is I'm not going to copy other people. I want this to be an actual kind of artistic expression. And so I didn't mind having coming up to the same conclusion. You know what I mean? Like if I independently came up with the same idea of how to solve the same problem, totally fine. But if I knew somebody else had already done it, that would draw the line. How do you feel about that?
It's like connected to our deep, like inner teenager selves. Like I don't want to be like my parents, even though you take after them in some ways, you know, like same thing with ideas. Yeah, I don't know. I guess the way that I relate to that at the moment, because I'm getting a little older now, is I kind of ignore media for not all of it, but I ignore a lot of media that I used to watch all the time because I was part of it. And that's how I kind of keep my ideas in their own bubble and feel like I'm being original,
but,
I guess.
But you still watch Tiny House Nation, though, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Sometimes.
Liar. What a liar. I love it.
Not often enough. Yeah, no, I don't watch TV very much, actually.
But hold on. I want to go back to this because I'm going to be a contrarian a little bit to this originality idea. And then I want to ask you what the future is. And we've already taken a bunch of your time. But I used to think about that a lot from a storytelling perspective, right? And that the same thing, like I almost didn't want to see, because then it's too easy to like be derivative or copy that. And I was like, yeah, if I come up with the same thing independently, all that stuff you were saying, and that's really hard. It's really hard to hold yourself to a level of, I have to be totally original. And then my mom, who's an artist as well, got me a book that said, was titled Steal Like an Artist. And the idea was, there's nothing fully original, right? What it is all derivative. So in other words, find the three woodworkers that you think are really, really good. Sam Maloof, Zach Giffen, you know, Abel Zill. Find those guys. Borrow from each of them. Find out who their three inspirations were. Get into that. And so it's actually just taking little bits and pieces from all over the place and how you combine them. That's where the originality is. And so as soon as that happened for me, it took so much pressure off. I was like, oh, if I like something that this performer does, I'm not going to be him, but I can take that piece. And so I like that for originality.
That makes sense, because like different inspiring artists, they're taking these pieces themselves and putting them together and telling a story, so to speak, whether it's a story or building something or writing an opera or whatever. And that's where, like, if you just take bits and pieces and regurgitate them, then they're just bits and pieces and they don't come together to tell a story. So as an artist, you have to tell a story. And yeah, you're right. Like by using pieces from other people, you're not just copying them. It's this language that kind of, we all speak together. So it's okay to tell similar stories because humans like each other's stories, whether the story is a house or an opera or a TV show.
Yeah. I mean, and it's like you said too, Abel, it's like, even if someone is going to rip one of your designs, it's not going to be the same. They're going to bring their own thing to it. Just as you brought boat building techniques of curved wood and stuff, and now you've elevated that to something. That's where I think from a creative endeavor, if you can let yourself off the hook a little bit and be like, oh, it's okay to take influences and know that how I put them together or how I interpret them is going to be original. But trying to come up with that thing that's never, ever happened before, I found that at least to be paralyzing and just like I couldn't start on anything.
Yeah.
I don't have the mental capacity of you and Zach, though. So maybe that's just it.
Well, I got a really personal question for you, because this is something that, you know, I come from my family as a manufacturing background. And so, you know, I think about my dad's tools that he's designed as kind of his form of art. He was a production potter. He was an artist, but now his art is designing products and elevating the function and then taking it all the way through to the production capacity and kind of mass producing this. And then even though it's mass produced, I feel like it inherently that's just another part of the artistry. And so the question I have for you is, you know, I see your homes as so gorgeous and so amazing. And you only build, you know, like you said, 2-3 homes a year. And so it's just not possible for that many people to be able to enjoy your homes and your designs. And my question is, how would it make you feel if somebody, like, say I was a big business guy and I came to you and I said, my God, I love what you're doing. And I want to take your designs and I want to throw it into a factory process and I want to produce them. How would that make you feel if that, and I'm not trying to propose this, but like, is that something you could handle, you know? Or are you so protective of your art that that would hurt?
I mean, yes and no. I'm not totally closed to something like that. And it, like, relationships in my life is a lot to do with the person. Like, if I encountered somebody who had an idea and I like who they are and what they're doing, you know, on like a more personal level, then I could be totally okay with that. I do have maybe rather picky standards about quality and materials. And I understand that those would have to be rewritten a little bit to do a manufacturing process, but it's not impossible at all to make these kind of tiny houses in more volume. And housing is a really intense, important concern right now. So something I think about all the time, because I'm not building very many houses. Their people are come after me and will give me money to build really pretty, unique houses just for them. But that doesn't totally satisfy the housing crisis.
Well, listen, it's every little bit.
You know that.
When it comes to big things like that, something is better than nothing. And you are certainly not doing nothing. The houses are incredible. If you want to see the houses yourselves, Zilvardos.com is a great place to go to check them out. Abel, we've taken so much of your time already. I really appreciate it. Super informative. And I know Zach had a blast as well. So thank you so much for being here, bud.
Yeah, thanks, Zach. Thanks, John. It was fun. And I just wanted to throw in, new website should go up fairly soon. ZillTinyHomes.com, all run together. But Zilvardos.com will still get you a result.
So. And Zill, Z-Y-L. We'll have it in the show notes and stuff. But yeah, absolutely. Yep. Abel, keep up the good work. It's incredible. It's really inspiring to see. And from one wannabe artist to another, it's really cool to see the level of commitment you put into everything you do. So thank you so much.
Yeah. Now that I know that you actually have kind of some, you're like semi-okay with other people kind of incorporating some inspiration from you into their own design, don't be surprised if, like, some of my homes that I start building in the future start looking a little more like yours. So I'm just warning you. I love what you do.
I'm okay with that.
I would love it if somebody would take your homes and put them into a factory process, because I just think that the world would be better off if more and more people had access to live in gorgeous works of art the way that I see your homes as. So thank you for doing what you're doing and keeping it up. And
I agree. Thank you
for setting the standard of principle in terms of yourself and your life, but also the homes that you produce. I think that right now, as the tiny home movement moves more and more towards kind of factory process and, you know, producing larger and larger homes, I think that your principles are more important than ever right now. So keep it up. We appreciate you.
How happy are you? You're so smiley right now.
I mean, well, it's just such a treat. In my mind, he's like the Picasso of the tiny home world for me, you know? And the one thing that I feel very passionately about is that we got to go to so many different places and work with so many different builders. And if you do that as a, you know, as a tradesman, and you go with an open mind and don't think that you know everything, well, then you get to learn from all of these different people everywhere you go. And I know that I'm a better carpenter for having gotten that experience. And I just wish we could have done an episode with Abel, because I would love to go and work side by side with him and, like, pick his brain and almost just,
yeah.
I would love to be an apprentice for a summer, honestly.
It almost sounds like what I said about creativity, where you pick and choose and you take influences. So I guess I was right about the creative process. I think that's what you're trying to say.
Well, John.
Also, I love that he has crazy socks and you have crazy socks. There are so many similarities between you guys. Deep thinkers.
We're both skiers.
Both skiers.
We both.
The whole thing.
Live in the Northwest.
Yeah, it was perfect. It was absolutely perfect.
And also, did you hear the part about how he, like, wanted a job that, like, didn't just leave him out in the rain, like building homes in the Northwest? And that's totally a thought process that I had gone through as well. living out here in the rainforest and kind of not necessarily wanting to spend my entire life outdoors in the rain.
The old soggy bottoms Giffen is what they call them. Well, listen, buddy, good episode. A lot of fun. I know you had a great time and let's do it again soon. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know how we're going to top it, but we'll try.
Oh, I know. We got so many toppers up our sleeves. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Okay. And last thing, we talked about Dee Williams. She's amazing. She's been an inspiration and she's a big part of actually getting this entire movement to the point where it is. And she wrote a book called The Big Tiny. If you haven't read it, please go buy her book. It's amazing. Not only is she an amazing person, an author, and has her own story, but now we know she's 100% responsible for getting the world to be able to appreciate the work of Abel. All right, John.
See you, bud.
Bye, buddy.